OK, so today I'll be talking about tides in gas-giant planets. And this is very preliminary work. I was motivated to do this in the last week when I was asked to give a talk. So hopefully it's even partially right. And I should also mention that there's also been some very nice work recently by Gordon and Doug, which is on AstroPH, on the same subject. So their paper is nice. It has lots of the history of the subject, in addition to lots of new material. OK, so. So when you have a binary system, and when the two objects get sufficiently close together, you can raise large tides on these objects. And when those tides are dissipated, you can deposit a fair amount of energy and angular momentum into the object. So that energy and angular momentum has to come from somewhere. So it's coming out of the orbit. Okay. So tides are a way to make the orbit of a binary system evolve. So let me just review two cases where we think that there may be significant orbital evolution happening. The first case is where you have Io orbiting around Jupiter. Jupiter is rotating very fast. And so this tide that Io raises on Jupiter, it produces a tidal bulge, which you can picture as sort of, you know, two little bumps there and there. Okay, and if there's some small amount of dissipation in Jupiter, then the tidal bulge won't be perfectly aligned with the line to Io. And this amount of misalignment, or this lag angle, it can be related to the amount of dissipation that's occurring. Okay, and that will be calling 1 over the Q parameter. So a high Q parameter means very little dissipation and very small lag angle. Okay, so once you know the size of these two little bumps here, and you know the size of your lag angle, you can calculate the torque on Io's orbit. And so you can work it out. It has something with the dimensions of torque coming from Jupiter quantities. And then this characteristic ratio of masses and ratio of radii cubed that you always get from tides. And it also goes like 1 over this tidal Q factor. Okay, and so it's sort of at this level of calculation, what people have always been using is they treat this Q as some unknown constant. There's no real theory for it at this point, because you just have two bumps. And then they try to see what value of Q would get agreement with the data. So that's sort of the level where this cartoon picture is at. The next case, which is interesting, is circularization of the extrasolar planet orbits around their star. So what we observe is that the orbits seem to be circularized in a period of a few days, whereas when you're at a much longer period, you can have, you know, any eccentricity you want. So in this case, what's happening is that most likely the planet has already been synchronized. So the planet is always keeping the same face towards the star. Okay, and what's happening is that the star and the planets, the orbit is oscillating like this. And so you have this time-varying tide which is acting on the planets, and again raising these two bumps. So again, if there's some dissipation in the planets, the motion of the fluid in these bumps won't be, you know, perfectly in phase with the tide. And you can calculate how much energy you'd be expecting to dissipate here. And then you can calculate, you know, what's the change in eccentricity for the orbit. So again, you can see you have, you know, this enormous power of, you know, the separation between the two objects. And it also depends directly on this Q parameter. OK, so in all these cases, you're sort of using this simple theory, which was, you know, developed, whatever, 100 years ago. And it's at the level of, you know, just using the observations to try and take this Q parameter and see what is it. Okay, there's no physics at this point to try and determine what the Q should be. Okay, so what do you end up getting for these two cases? So just to remind you, what is Q? It's basically the energy that you're storing in the tide divided by the energy that you dissipate in the tide during one period. Okay, so again, high Q means small dissipation. So the two cases where people have tried to place a constraint on this dissipation parameter are the first case is where if tides have pushed Io into this resonance with the outer satellites Europa and Ganymede, okay, and this gives you a bound on Q that has to be less than a order about a million, okay, which is actually, it's much bigger than what you have for the terrestrial planets. for the circularization of extrasolar planet orbits, for this to happen at 3 days, again, you're going to need a Q, which is of order a million. Okay, so it seems consistent. You know, for gas giant planets, even for these two different situations, you're getting roughly the same Q parameter. And interestingly, and I won't talk about it anymore today, is that you get roughly the same Q parameter for circularization of main sequence binaries, if that's going to happen in about 12 days. Okay, so now we know the observations for what is this dissipation rate. How does this theory stack up against it? So there's this sort of long-standing controversy, and I just want to describe where did this controversy come about. So the first calculation for a realistic model of Jupiter was by Hubbard, and he was trying to determine if you have some tidal flow which is set up in the planet, then how fast can that tidal flow be dissipated by turbulent viscosity. So basically, picture turbulent viscosity is that you have these eddies moving around because you have this turbulent planet, and they're able to transport momentum from one place to another. Okay, and that can act to erase the shear, and so which is a damping for the wave. Okay, so if you know the turbulent viscosity, you can easily estimate the damping rates. And so since viscosity goes something like a velocity times a length, turbulent viscosity ends up involving the luminosity, which is coming from the planet, basically because this velocity of the eddies is just what you need to carry the energy flux out of the planet. Okay, and so you can just make a dimensional analysis estimate of what this viscosity should be, and you end up with a Q parameter, which is the ratio of two different luminosities. What's in the numerator here is basically the luminosity, which is radiating or binding energy in one dynamical time. And then in the denominator, it's the actual luminosity of the star, which is 15 orders of magnitude smaller. Okay, so Hubbard's original calculation was that you're taking this ratio, 10 to the 15 to the 1/3 power, and you get something which is pretty close to the right answer. Okay, so if people had just stopped there, then you know, this would be a closed book. But what Goldreich and Nicholson noticed is that these energy-bearing eddies that Hubbard was using to try and erase the shear actually have a turnover time of over a couple years. Okay, so you have this tide which is forcing Jupiter at 5 hours, and you have eddies turning over in a couple years. Okay, so those eddies can't transport any momentum. Okay, so basically they can't be effective in damping the wave. So what they suggested is that you need to go to smaller length scale eddies, okay, which turn over much faster and can transport this momentum. Okay, but the penalty that you pay there is that if you use the Kolmogorov scaling for turbulence to see how much power is there at these much smaller scales, okay, there's going to be much smaller velocity fluctuations. And the effect of this is that you're going to decrease your turbulent viscosity by this factor omega times tau, where tau is the turnover time of the largest eddy. Okay, so basically, this is going to be something like 5 hours over 2 years squared. Okay, and so that's the origin of the controversy is that this is giving you a much, much smaller viscosity than you need to actually give you the correct orbital evolution. Okay, and so in terms of this ratio of luminosities, radiating or binding energy in a dynamical time to the actual luminosity from the star, instead of being to the 1/3 power, for this reduced viscosity, now it's just to the power of 1, and so you get a number of order 10 to the 15. Okay, and so if you actually do an honest calculation, what you find is that the disagreement for this dissipation rate between theory and observation is of order 10 million. Okay, so not very common. You know, maybe only the cosmological constant is a worse disagreement. Okay, so at this point, you know, everything. There have been a couple attempts since then to try and put more physics in. What I want to talk about, and which Doug and Gordon have worked on recently, is trying to do a better job at what is the fluid motion excited in the planet by the tide. So basically, what people have done initially is to ignore the inertia of the fluid in the planet. And so basically, you're just squeezing it, and you get the two bumps there, and the two bumps are just static. Okay, so what you want to try next is actually solve the hydrodynamics problem of what happens when you're, you know, periodically squeezing a planet. And so what happens in this case is that, I mean, what you're trying to do is actually just see, can you resonantly excite waves in the planet? Okay, so the first question to ask then is, what waves do you have available? Okay, in a non-rotating planet, you would have no waves except for sound waves in the convective core. Okay, and so sound waves have a frequency which is much higher than the forcing frequency, so you can't resonantly excite them. Okay, but in a rotating gas giant planet, in this convective core, you do have low frequency waves, and the restoring force is just from the Coriolis force, from the fact that you have a rotating planet. Okay, so you can easily write down the dispersion relation for these waves. It goes like 2 omega spin times the wave number along the rotation axis divided by the total wave number. Okay, and the amplitude of these, of the velocity in these waves basically grows strongly towards the surface, like 1 over square root of rho. Okay, so the main thing to keep in mind here is that this formula right here, the only characteristic direction for that these waves know about is the rotation axis. Okay, so they don't, to leading order, they don't really know they're in a spherical star yet. That's just sort of the boundary conditions acting on them later on. Okay, and so what you expect then is that the nodes that you see in your eigenfunction, say in the pressure perturbation, there will be nodes along the z direction and along the cylindrical radius direction. Okay, so this is very different from the case of a non-rotating star or planet where it's stably stratified and you have nodes in spherical radius and also in the polar angles. Okay, so these waves are actually much, much different than people are used to studying, and much of the difficulty is actually in solving for them. So especially in the hot Jupiters, and maybe not as much in the cold Jupiters, there's eventually going to be a region where it's no longer convective and you have radiation transport. And so it'll be stably stratified, so that if you perturb a fluid element upward, it'll just oscillate. Now, in this region, the type of waves that you get are called, I'll call them rotationally modified G-modes. There's like 50 different names for them, but let's just use that name. So it turns out you can, in one line, you can derive the main property of these waves. So the dispersion relation now has this term that comes from the Coriolis force, but then there's the usual term that you get from the buoyancy force, which involves the Brunt-Weissalla frequency, or the buoyancy frequency, and then it goes like the horizontal wave number in the theta and phi direction divided by the total wave number. Okay, so now if you look at, there's one interesting thing here, is that if you look at low frequency waves, okay, then the radial wave number has to be much bigger than the horizontal wave number. Okay, and the wave number along the rotation axis is just radial wave number times cosine theta. So if I just plug these two expressions in here, then what I find is that the horizontal wave number squared is just the radial wave number squared times this quantity, frequency squared minus 4 omega spin squared cosine squared theta. Okay? And so typically the frequency is less than the spin frequency, and so you can see that this thing can change sign. Okay, so if kr squared is greater than 0, so you're vertically propagating, then what this expression says is that you only propagate horizontally if you're close to the equator. Okay, and so what the waves in this case look like out in the envelope, well, I should have just drawn this out in the envelope, is that you have nodes along the radial direction and along the angular direction, but everything is squeezed into near the equator. Okay, and the amplitude for these waves, similar to the convective core case, it grows strongly towards the surface. Okay, so this is sort of the type of waves that you expect to be excited in the planet. So now you might wonder, there's been all this work on tides in non-rotating stars. How does this carry over when you have rotation, or what's different in the two cases? Okay, there's two main points to keep in mind. The first one is that in a non-rotating star, you can separate variables in spherical radius and theta and phi. Okay, and so what your eigenfunctions look like, say for the pressure perturbation, is it would look like one spherical harmonic. Okay, but when you include the Coriolis force, what ends up happening is that you destroy that spherical symmetry, and you end up having to sum each eigenfunction that you find over all spherical harmonics. They have some power at all spherical harmonics. And so the reason this is interesting is that the tidal force is actually one spherical harmonic. Okay, so in a non-rotating star, you would fix the L and the M quantum numbers for the mode, and then you can only vary the number of radial nodes. But what happens in a rotating star is that now since every mode has some piece along this Y2M spherical harmonic, you now have two quantum numbers that you can vary. Okay, and the place that this comes that this is interesting is that if you're trying to find a good resonance between the tidal forcing frequency and the frequency of the mode, now you have two quantum numbers to adjust instead of just one, which is the case for a non-rotating star. Okay, and so what you can imagine doing is, if you let these two quantum numbers both go to infinity while keeping their ratio roughly the same, then you could get arbitrarily good resonance with the tide. Okay, so it's interesting that, you know, it's possible to get much, much better resonance just all the time than you would have for a non-rotating star. Okay, this is the best you can do in a few days of trying to make a talk. I'm hoping I can get better models. This is my crappy model for a cold Jupiter. Okay, so what this diagram is going to show you is where can waves propagate inside the star. Okay, so down here on this axis is pressure. So here's the surface, and here's the center. And then there's this thing called the propagation diagram, where you plot the characteristic frequencies associated with the planet. The first one is the buoyancy frequency. Okay, so this is large on the outside, and it becomes, you know, essentially zero in the convective core. And then there's the Lamb frequency, which is basically sound speed over radius. And it's large in the center where the temperature is high, and it decreases towards the surface. Okay, so now if you just look at the dispersion relation, you can see that waves can only propagate when G-modes can only propagate when they're below both of these curves. Okay, so this would say that G-modes can only propagate out here in the stably stratified region near the surface. Okay, but in addition, you can only get a propagating wave if the frequency of the wave is in this region. Okay, so for a cold Jupiter model where the temperature is maybe 100 Kelvin at the surface, okay, if you just compare the forcing frequency of Io, which is way up here, to the allowed region where you get propagating G-modes, then what this is telling you is that this forcing by Io is not actually able to drive propagating waves out here for low angle number waves. Basically, you can have waves out here, but then they just sort of evanesce once they get to the surface. Okay, so for the cold Jupiter case, it seems like not much is going on out here. For the hot Jupiter case, since the Lamb goes like the sound speed, and sound speed goes like temperature, you can bump this up to about there. And in addition, the forcing frequency is much lower. So in the hot Jupiter case, it seems like maybe you can get propagation out there. But again, that's really where you really want a good model for what's happening on the outside of the star, or the planet. The second thing to remember is inertial modes can propagate in the convective core for any frequency, forcing frequency, below twice the spin frequency. Okay, so I've written a code which actually solves for the response of a star or planet to a tidal force. And I apologize for the psychedelic colors here. That's me not knowing how to work IDL. So what this code does is it finds the linearized response to an external force. Okay, and there's two assumptions in it. The first one is that there's no dissipative processes or heat exchange between fluid elements. And the second assumption is that I just treat the background star as approximately spherical, because to do any better would be much, much more complicated. Okay, so the point I want to get across here is that if you're forcing the planet very close to one of its resonant frequencies, then you excite one of these inertial waves in the core. Okay, and it looks, you know, just like we were picturing. There's a certain number of nodes along the z-axis and a certain number of nodes along the cylindrical radius direction. Okay, so it's sort of exactly what you'd expect from the naive dispersion relation. Okay, however, if I go slightly off resonance, okay, then the amplitude of this wave now becomes much, much smaller, and the main response that you're seeing is just basically the bump. You know, it's the thing you always picture in your mind of what a tide looks like, just the bump, which has the same angular dependence as the tidal force itself. Okay, and so in the literature, these two different types of situations are usually called the equilibrium tide, where it really does look like the bump, or it's a dynamical tide where you're driving an actual normal mode of oscillation. And I should mention, what's plotted here is just the pressure perturbation. Okay.
The magnitude of the velocity perturbation. can you put any constraints on what is people tend to attempted to observe in Jupiter oscillation? I presume you will get to it.
No, I
can observations, yeah. Right, at the surface, yeah. Layer.
Yeah.
And for Jupiter's oscillation, and I don't know whether you can put some constraints in relation to what you just
I don't. I don't have anything to present here. It would. The only thing I worry about is, I mean, it's what you mentioned the other day, is that you have these very strong zonal flows, which may disrupt. I mean, if you send a wave out there, it'll just get ripped apart. So I'm not exactly sure. You really need to know the amplitude to get that right.
Was rotation included in those newly colored plots?
Yeah, that's the main point, is that any, you can give a project to any undergrad to do non-rotating stars. It's very easy. You just spend, you spend a week and you write your shooting code and that's it. But with this, I spent months, writing matrix inversion routines, and it's horrifically complicated to get the Coriolis force in there non-perturbatively. Yeah.
I thought you said in the dispersion relation that things are confined near the equator.
No, that's in this tiny thin layer near the surface. Okay. And actually for the model I'm using, the waves don't propagate there because it's too cold. Yeah. Okay, so what this plot shows is if the forcing period of Jupiter by Io was slightly different, then what would the response look like? Okay, and so this is, right, what I'm plotting here is the energy of the response, just tally up the energy that's in this fluid motion, and then just tabulate it as a function of the period of the forcing. And so what you can see is that you can actually get this very, very fine structure of, tiny little resonances sitting right next to each other. Okay, but I guess the main point I want you to take away here is that look at the big guys here. See, this one has this very broad resonance. This one has a very broad resonance. Here, here, here. These, that one. Okay. So some of the waves have these very broad resonances. Okay. And what this means is that they actually have a large overlap integral with the tide. The tidal force is able to do a lot of work on them. Okay. But then there's other waves that you see that have these, like this one. It's these very narrow resonances. And what's happening with those is that these tend to be the waves that have a much shorter length scale. They have a very short propagation length scale, and that overlap integral with the tide is much, much smaller because you're integrating the tide, which is a smoothly varying function, against some rapidly varying sinusoidal type function, and so you get lots of cancellation error. Okay, and so what you're seeing here then is that the modes that have small numbers of nodes seem like the ones that have very, very large overlap with the tide. When you include large numbers of nodes, you get these very thin resonances. Okay, and I should also mention that this was for, in my code, this was for a very low resolution, only of order 100 points in radius and 8 spherical harmonics. This was just a time constraint of what could I do in 1 week. If you increase this resolution, what you'll end up seeing is that you'll see more of these very thin resonances appear everywhere. And it basically looks like you're growing hair on top of these nice smooth curves.
Phil, do you use the traditional approximation?
No. There's no approximations except for adiabatic and spherical background star.
Okay.
Yeah.
So both the propagation in the radial and azimuths.
Yes.
In the Coriolis.
Yes.
Force.
It's all there. Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this a uniform rotation?
Uniform rotation, right.
It's got to play a role. What you assume.
Right.
More than that, it's extraordinarily.
Yeah.
But I mean, the real thing is likely
sure,
to be differentially.
Sure. Sure. But how do you know? What in the convective region, what do you do? What is rotating, or what is,
Well, you know for sure that the convective zone of the sun is not in.
Yes, exactly.
So you know that.
I think everyone is aware of that problem. And it's a first step, even to get to this stage, is extraordinarily difficult. And in that next stage, what we said, is certainly an area that needs to be looked at.
But qualitatively, what do you think it will do if you have differential rotation? I mean,
There's one big problem, which was pointed out by Goldreich and Nicholson again, is that for instance, when you're, for instance, if you're synchronizing one of the extrasolar giant planets and bringing it down to a slower rotation rate, then the way that this happened is that you excite a wave, and it bounces around in the star for a while, in the planet for a while, and then it dissipates where there's large viscosity, and it tends to be in a surface region, and so you're going to be depositing momentum up there, and then you're going to be starting very strong differential rotation in an outer layer. And then waves won't be able to propagate into that region anymore because there'll be a co-rotation barrier. So that's the main place. But this problem itself isn't actually worked out yet. So people are just working on this first. Okay. So what I wanted to do is challenge myself and actually quote a number that everyone can laugh at, you know, later on when I find out I did something wrong. This is my estimate using the code for the Q value that you get for Jupiter being forced by Io. And the dissipation that I'm looking at here is turbulent viscosity in the convection zone. Basically, the turbulent viscosity is going to be proportional to 1 divided by the pressure. And so since the pressure is decreasing enormously towards the surface, and the amplitude of the wave is increasing enormously towards the surface, your dissipation rate is really coming all from the surface layers, essentially at the top of the convection zone. So if you're interested in heating, that's where the heat would be input, most likely. So what we do then is we can write down this expression for the torque which is being applied on the orbit, and then we parameterize it in terms of this Q value. What my code measures is actual energy deposition, okay? And so what I'm going to do is calculate this energy deposition and then try and do some sort of an average over time, and then from that average, compute a Q value. Okay, but the thing you have to realize here is that when you hit a resonance, the height of the tide becomes enormous, okay? And so all of a sudden, you're exerting an enormous torque on the orbit, and it's just going to move you right out of resonance, okay? And so basically, the time that you spend in resonance, the time that you spend in any frequency interval goes like 1 over the energy deposition rate. Okay, and so the correct average to use for evolution of an orbit then is this one, where you're basically integrating 1 over E dot. And what it does is it penalizes the part of the orbit which is resonant, and it's mainly putting all the weight for orbital evolution in the off-resonant part.
Do you integrate over one?
Well, I'll show you one. It's on the next plot. But basically, what I did is I computed this E dot as a function of frequency for a very fine mesh of frequency, and then I averaged it over finite size frequency intervals. So that's what I'll be showing on this next plot. Okay. So again. This is being the integrals that I'm doing here are for frequency intervals which are 1/100th of the spin frequency, okay? And so what you can see then is that instead of getting these extremely fine structures, what you're sort of doing is smoothing it out a bit more. And these big peaks here correspond to the wide resonances that you were seeing from the low order modes, okay? So the hope is that if I went to fantastically higher precision, maybe you'd still get the same answer, because it seems like it's mainly the lower waves.
Sorry, I missed. Where does that 100 come from?
I just chose that. I mean, I have 10,000 frequency. I had this function E dot as a function of omega at 10,000 points, and I just had to bin it and do the integral. No, I understand. If you change the binning, you'll get something that looks completely different. So if I integrated over this region right here, I would have smoothed it into something like that. So then it comes down to the question of what's the interesting average for the actual orbital evolution for that system.
What does nature do?
Well, nature is probably taking Io from near co-rotation and moving it out to a much further distance. So that's basically integrating this thing from low forcing frequencies to higher forcing frequencies.
But what's the right smoothing?
Well, there's one possibility that Gordon's looking at is that the structural change in Jupiter, because the point is Jupiter is still contracting. So therefore, in fact, its spin state is changing. So that's what we're looking at, some aspect. And
yeah.
When you take that into account, this what you the question you're asking falls.
This is the minimum evolution rate. So then if you do something like that, it's only going to increase it.
What you said about hitting a resonance and then the thing will quickly, because the orbit will evolve quickly, it will quickly go through and move out of resonance. The other thing that could presumably happen is that when you hit a resonance, the mode starts leaking through mode-mode coupling.
Yeah, I'm in the process of estimating that right now. Yeah.
Because then, then what you would presumably get is more of a, as you hit all these resonances, and every time you hit one, it starts looking into all kinds of other modes, and you just get a big turbulent mess.
Right. So, for a completely different project, my collaborators and I had done, we'd shown that inertial waves can support a turbulent cascade of energy from large scales to small scales. Okay, and so basically, you're going to end up getting something like that. So you're putting all the energy in at large scales by the tide, and then it can go down to smaller scales. And the effective dissipation rate for the waves then is, it just depends on the amplitude that they're at. And so it's independent of viscosity. And so what might be interesting about that is that you'll get a completely different scaling of the torque on radius, for instance, because now it depends on the amplitude of the wave, which is fixed by the orbital separation too. So I'm trying to estimate that right now. Yeah. So Doug had also done a something similar in a recent paper. Okay. So but there's numbers here. So 10 to the 18 to 10 to the 20. Let's just plug it in. What do we get for that? So if I take this formula and I plug in 10 to the 18 or 20 to the 20 for this E dot, then that translates into a Q value of order 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 when this thing goes from 10 to the 18 to 10 to the 20. Okay, so it's better than 10 to the 13. It's not quite there yet, but this is a pretty crappy job for 1 week. So so I'm hoping to find better Jupiter models is one thing, and then do things like resolution studies to make sure I'm actually getting the right answer. Okay, thanks.
Extraordinary calculations. These are very difficult calculations. I think this is really very, very good stuff.
Well, it's basically the same as what you guys were working on in the end. So I agree with you. And
about the surface deformation, how do you take care of that?
The centrifugal, the flattening?
The response, you have a free surface at the top.
Right now, just the crappy, Lagrangian pressure perturbation is zero. Okay. So there's nothing to push back on you when you're at the surface. Because I would need a better model that has non-adiabatic quantities to do better than this, I think.
Because I presume that you use an elastic approximation.
No, it's the full thing.
The full thing.
Yeah. There's the sound, I can do sound waves with that. It does the entire thing, yeah.
Presumably on the surface of these planets, the turbulent cascade is not going to go off because you get these vortices on Jupiter. Is that something that's important?
That's one of the mechanisms that's been proposed for heating of the extrasolar planets is that you get things like zonal flows, which can dissipate their energy. You're getting all the contribution to turbulent viscosity from the top of the convection zone. And then, hopefully these zonal flows might be, a little bit above that or roughly the same level. So it's messy. So I'm glossing over the hard part.
Oh, I had some